بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف المرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. So sisters and brothers, this is session number 5 with a simple theme, made men. And you can see now that the choice of words, not just with made men, but with excel, with impact, with love, with success. These are the sort of themes that I'll be discussing. I am trying to defy the stereotypes that people have about women. You think women are weak? They have impact. You think women are stubborn? You have U-turn. You think women might... This is a man speaking now. You think women are useless? Energy. They don't think about much things of use? Aspiration. They are not ambitious or excel. They are not usually that religious. Connect. And to a man that he thinks he is the master of the world, made men. So this is the 5th theme, made men. So what am I going to discuss in this theme? 3 paradigms, 3 lenses. And based upon these 3 paradigms, I'm selecting my stories. So I'm not going to exhaust the list. Don't tell me why haven't you spoke about X and Y and Z. I've chose a paradigm, and whoever fits that paradigm in a dramatic, fascinating, interesting, exciting, she has a story to tell, I take her. If she is nice, good, but she's boring, I say to her, excellent, but you are not appropriate. So, let us see who we have chosen. But first, let me introduce to you my 3 paradigms. Number 1, most of the famous Muslim men that we know and respect are the make of their mothers, sisters, or a female member in the family. Look, I'm telling you, I'm very specific. Are the make of their mothers, I could have said full stop, no, and sisters, or a female member in the family. There has to be a female member. For example, mother, or sister, or an aunt. Okay. But there has to be a female in the narrative. There has to. There has to. I'm certain. Now, a male historian comes and disguises that female member, that's his problem. I'm here to actually reveal that female member. So that's number 1. Number 2, with this reality in mind, some argue women are not, as is commonly mentioned, just half of the society, but in essence, I would say, are all of it. So we have females, half of the society, not 50-50, but half more or less, and they are responsible for the making of the other half. Then do you think it's a waste of time doing a course about women inspired by the beloved? Do you think it's a waste of time for men to know about their stories, if he is knowing the stories of those who made him? So this is paradigm number 2. 3, women will always continue to produce great men, and in the process will not care much if her name is recognized or not. This is the most fascinating thing about great women, is that they don't want to be recognized. Unlike many men. Yes, I am the mother of Bukhari. Excuse me, mother of Bukhari, what's your name? You don't have to know. Suffice it to know, my son. Hence, I am the mother of Bukhari. I am the mother of Shafi. Excuse me, what's your name? You don't have to know. But suffice it to know, because mothers are happy when you see the offspring and you recognize them. They don't want to come into the picture. Let's then begin with our narrative. And I have a few narratives in relation to mothers, But I wanted to go beyond the stereotype and talk to you about a sister that had an impact on her brother. With regards to mothers now, I have noticed that all these mothers, the mother of Imam Bukhari, the mother of Imam Shafi'i, the mother of Imam Ahmed ibn Hanbal, the mother of Rabi'a, were all single mothers. It's amazing. You know what single mother means. Not just living in a council flat and drunk and... No. Single mother means responsible mother. Being able to care about her children and produce good men. Okay. Let's begin with the mother of Imam Bukhari. And I'm not going to talk much about each character because I think I did this in other places when I talked about the life of Imam Bukhari and the four great imams. So I'm not going to repeat myself here. And if anything, I'm going to zoom the camera now on the female player in the narrative. I'm not going to market Bukhari and Shafi'i. I've done this already, and I'm not going to replicate that. Okay, what do we know about the mother of Imam Bukhari or Imam Shafi'i? Notice something. When we talk about the mother of Bukhari or Shafi'i or Ahmed ibn Hanbal or Malik ibn Anas, you would realize or you would notice that every mother had a contribution to make in the character of her son. One mother might not have taught her children or her great son much of knowledge, but lots of morals. Another mother cared about knowledge. What I'm trying to say is that all of the mothers gave their sons a tool, and that tool later was developed by the son. But at least she gave him something. Okay, Imam Bukhari, what did his mother give him? Immediately, and to dramatize what she gave him the ability to see. Imagine blind Imam Bukhari. Imagine a blind Imam. I know that he had a Xerox photographic memory. I know that. But still, imagine we have a blind Bukhari. Because he had a great memory, but all his notes were kept in writing. Imagine he was blind. Why do you have to imagine? He was blind. Imam Bukhari was blind. Do you know this? Well, no, he wasn't. Well, actually, he was blind during his childhood. And because of his mother's dua, he could see again. This is an immediate physical impact and contribution that the mother had on her child. Imam Bukhari was born an orphan. And his mother never got married. Now, getting married after the husband passes away, nothing is wrong with that. And there were many, many, many men that passed away and their wives got married. Nothing is wrong with that. But in our case, most if not all of the mothers never remarried. So we have a mother that makes dua that her son sees again. And we have a mother that sacrifices her desires for the sake of her son. Number two. Because then imagine when the mother gets married and the husband says, look, you have Bukhari. He's not my son. You know, I want a new baby. So Bukhari shouldn't come and visit us all the time. You should rent him a room or I don't know where. And Bukhari is an orphan and he's blind and no one takes care of him. Would we have Imam Bukhari as we have him today if we did not have a mother that committed her entire life for him? Think about that. So these are two important things, I think. Okay, let me dramatize the dua of the mother of Imam Bukhari. Why did Allah accept the mother's dua? Because the mother was a woman of karama. A woman of karama. And karama means that she is so close to Allah, so connect. She's connecting to Allah so much so that whenever she asks for something, Allah gives it to her. So imagine these scenarios. Between a mother and between a blind child. Various scenarios. Imagine a mother that is not religious, a mother that is not a good worshipper, a mother that is not of a karamat. whatever dua she will make, Allah will never answer. And Bukhari will remain blind. Okay, imagine a mother with karamat. Imagine a mother that is religious, but a mother that never thought about making dua for her son. Never occurred to her mind. Then we have a good mother, but yet a blind imam. Okay, imagine a mother that is of karamat, that thought about dua, but and Bukhari can see, alhamdulillah, but after he could see, that was it. That was the entire relationship between him and her. So what are we talking about? I'm trying to dramatize her role. We are talking about a good mother. We are talking about a mother that was close to Allah. We are talking about a mother that made dua. We are talking about a mother that after Allah opened his eyes, she supported him financially, physically, and emotionally until he became the scholar that we know today. That is the mother of Imam Bukhari. Four contributions and impacts that she had on her son. It's not enough to say he had a good mother. We all have good mothers. But good in terms of what? Feeding me chicken and meat and... But for a mother to make dua every night and cry for me and say, oh Allah, make him see again, this is a unique mother. Shafi'i, radiallahu anhu. Shafi'i is a Hashemite. But he was born in Gaza, in Palestine. His father passed away. So again, like Bukhari, we are talking about single mother, we are talking about orphan. His father passed away while Shafi'i was in the womb of his mother. So actually, Shafi'i never saw his father. The concept of fatherhood does not come in the minds of Imam Shafi'i. His entire life is his mother. In the books of history, we are told by people like Ibn Hajar that his mother was a great worshipper. Again, we have a unique mother. You know why I'm focusing on this? I know that every mother by nature loves her daughter, loves her son, wants her son to be... But here I'm talking about natural mothers, yes. But they went beyond being natural mother into someone who has a vision, someone who has ideas, who has aspirations about what they want their children to be. Not that he has to do a PhD and get a job in the city. No, that he has to be unique in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You see, that's why I feel they are different, those mothers. So Imam Ibn Hajar says, وَكَانَتْ مِنَ الْعَابِدَاتِ. She was a great worshipper. So what did she decide, the mother of Imam Shafi'i? She decided, first of all, she will never get married. She was young, beautiful, but not to marriage. Don't try this at home. But she decided not to get married. She decided that my project is to make something out of this person. Incidentally, bear in mind that at that time, she never thought that she will be bringing someone who was a mujaddid in the fiqh and someone who has followers in millions all over the world. She didn't have this in mind. And to be honest, she didn't care. She thought, this is Shafi'i, this is a Muttalibi, this is a Hashemite, I have to take care of him as a mother. So number one, I'm not going to get married. Number two, why should we remain in Gaza? Why should we remain in Palestine? He's a Hashemite, he belongs to Mecca, so I'm going to take him to Mecca. So now we zoom the camera into the mother, watching her, packing her stuff, going from Gaza through checkpoints, you know, going from Gaza, etc., taking the sea, traveling, all the hardship, reaching Mecca. Why? Tourism? No. Because she wants her son to get the best education. Well, she could have went to Oxford. No, no, no. The best education in deen. And Mecca was the Oxford of Islam, if you want. So she took him to Mecca, and Imam Shafi'i says, my mother was extremely poor. She did not have money to give to the sheikh by way of a salary. And the sheikh agreed and accepted that I to learn for free only because I'm a Muttalibi, only because I'm a Hashemite. So out of respect, and also out of a particular service that when the sheikh leaves the students, Shafi'i will take care of them until he comes. So he said, okay, you do that, and I'm not going to take money from you. But the point was that despite the fact that the mother was poor, she had this ambition that I'm going to travel to Mecca. Okay, do you have money? It doesn't matter. Do you have the fees? It doesn't matter. What matters is with my commitment, with my discipline, with my ibadah, I'm going to make something out of this baby. And she succeeded. And she did it. And that's why Imam Shafi'i is so grateful to his mother. And that's maybe why Imam Shafi'i has no problems asking Nafisa, a woman, to make dua for him. Because in his life, he knows nothing or no one other than a female, other than mother. So I have no gender complexities. Okay, this is Shafi'i. Let's talk about Ahmed ibn Hanbal. The mother of Ahmed ibn Hanbal did not inculcate much knowledge in Ahmed ibn Hanbal, but she inculcated adab, or akhlaq, or morals, or good attitude. Imam Ahmed ibn Hanbal, sisters and brothers, Imam Ahmed ibn Hanbal was famous even when he was a young boy, but not as a faqih or a scholar of jurisprudence, but of a nice, cute, lovely boy who was well-mannered, who would say thank you and no thank you and yes please and table manners and all the rest. He was the well-mannered boy. So much so that one man made a fascinating comment on Ahmed ibn Hanbal. One man said to his friend, he said, I get the best teachers, the mu'addibin. Back then there was this custom to employ mu'addibin, not teachers to teach 1 + 1 = 2. No, to teach the children manners. They call them the mu'addibin, coming from the word adab. So, especially people who come from wealthy backgrounds, they used to employ mu'addibin. The mu'addib would sit with the boy, teaches him manners as a complement to the role of the father and the mother. So this man tells his friend, he says, I spend a lot of money on trying to make my sons well-mannered, but no way are their manners matching with this orphan boy. That's what he says. And who is he talking about? Ahmed ibn Hanbal. You know what I said here? I said the mother made her son already famous, so much so that society has already begun to talk about him. But society at that time was not speaking about his knowledge because he was too young, but speaking about his morals. It was the mother that was the reason for the source of fame of Ahmed ibn Hanbal. Without the mother, Ahmed Hanbal would have been, I don't know, doing what? So, what does this tell you? It tells you that ilm comes after adab, and that knowledge comes after akhlaq. The problem with us today in the West is that we are eager to learn Arabic, and that we are eager to learn fiqh, and that we are eager to say, this is madhab, this, should I follow a madhab? This is that. But we don't have akhlaq. We don't have adab. My mother didn't teach me adab. She taught me how to cook. My father didn't teach me. He taught me how to do the mathematics so that in the corner shop I would sell the cigarettes or the top shelf magazines for £1. I don't know, not for... That's what they taught me. I mean, this is an extreme example. What I'm saying is that we never, a lot of us, have not been internalizing akhlaq. Akhlaq is so superficial. We learn it through books and through lectures. What I'm telling you now here is that Ahmed ibn Hanbal, before he became a faqih, he was a mu'addab. So much so that he was an impressive case to men around him. Malik ibn Anas. I'm shifting now. Shifting to another scholar. Of course, I chose these mothers. You know why? Because, unfortunately, they are the mothers of famous men. So I had to introduce them through Ahmed, through Malik. One day we need to introduce Ahmed and Malik through them, rather than the opposite. Of course, I'm not by no means, I did the four great imams. But what I'm saying is that we should also see the other side of the coin. Malik ibn Anas is a great faqih, as you know. His mother was not single mother. He had his father with him, but it was the mother that actually played the active role in bringing Malik ibn Anas into society as a great man of akhlaq. In fact, the mother of Imam Malik said to him, go to Rabi'ah. And Rabi'ah was a scholar in Medina. She said to him, I want you to go to Rabi'ah. And I want you to learn from his manners before you learn from his knowledge. What is fascinating here in this story is that the mother is aware of the scholars in Medina. So this is Rabi'ah, this is Hamza, this is Ali. Not only that, she is able to scrutinize them and who is good at knowledge and who is good at adab and who is good at fiqh and who is good at hadith. Not only that, but she is able even to direct her son as to begin with what first. She didn't say go to X and learn from his ilm because now it's, you know, ilm is fashionable and conferences, everyone wants to be a scholar. No, no, no. As a mother, I know that you have to have adab first. So, O Malik, go to Rabi'ah and learn from his adab before his ilm. And when he learned from Rabi'ah adab, he said to her, now, O mother, I am ready to learn. Shall I go now to learn? She said, come, come. Now, I will give you the clothes of knowledge. تعال فلبس ثياب العلم. There isn't certain clothes for knowledge, like martial arts or whatever. But at that time, when people wanted to go to sit with a scholar, they would wear a turban, nice clothes, white clothes with perfumes, etc. You know what's fascinating here? The mother is directing him to go to adab before ilm. Once he attains adab, graduates with a BA in adab, then she says to him, okay, now you are fit with ilm. Look what I've done to you. I've been sewing this turban, now come. And she actually does the turban for him. And she says to him, go, go. Now you are ready to learn the ilm. Now imagine, where will Malik be without this great mother? He will be confused. Studying medicine and then discovering, no, I'm not a medic, I want to do economics. And then going into economics and then dropping and going and studying Sharia in Mauritania for 4 years. And then from Mauritania, he goes to Kosovo for, I don't know, 4 years. And then he doesn't know what he's doing. He's trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. How old are you, brother? 45 years old. No, here you have a mother. Now you are 5 years, okay, learn adab. Now you are 7 years, come, I'll do the turban for you. Now you are 8 years, okay, Rabi'ah is enough, now go to Hamza. Hamza now is good for those who are aged 7. That is the mother. She has a vision. She knows what she's doing. Okay, Rabi'ah, and this is the final story with mothers. Rabi'ah, you don't know much perhaps about Rabi'ah. Rabi'ah is the person, the scholar that the mother of Imam Malik said to her son, go to Rabi'ah, learn from his adab before his ilm. Well, Rabi'ah was a scholar in adab and in ilm, but he was more known for his adab and for his akhlaq. And it's amazing. And sometimes you meet scholarly people, but you say, you know, okay, he's knowledgeable, but, or vice versa. And it's hardly that you see people combining knowledge and adab. Rabi'ah was that combination. Okay, Rabi'ah himself was the product of his mother. And his story is fascinating and is unbelievable. And I'm going to narrate to you his story. Rabi'ah's father left him when he was a baby in the womb of his mother. And left with his mother 30,000 dinar. I'm not sure how many in dollars, but quite a lot of money during that time. Or sterling. He left her to fight somewhere. Do you know for how many years he left her? Couple of years, 3 years, 6, 10, 15, 27 years. 27 years. In fiqh, when a wife loses her husband, whether he's dead or alive, for over, I don't know how many years, she has the right to get married. But you don't understand, this is the mother of Rabi'ah. It's not about marriage, it's about this baby. I don't want to lose this baby. I don't want to do abortion. I don't want to throw him to the social security and they will take care of him. No, I will live for that baby. even for 27 years, even if it took me 27 years. Okay, what are you going to do? There is no male guardian. There is no one to work. Well, he left me 30,000 dinar. I'm going to spend it on that baby. Will it last for 27 years? Well, I'll try to do my best. After 27 years, the father comes and opens the door of his house. If I was him, I would say, at least, you know, 27 years, where is my house? Maybe it has changed. Maybe my wife is dead. At least let me knock the door. He didn't. To him, 27 years is like 27 minutes. He opened the door. And so, a 27 years old man in front of him. And he said to him, what are you doing in this house, you stranger? And the 27 years old man said, what the hell are you doing? I mean, they didn't say what the hell, but what are you doing here? That's my house. He said, what? That's my house, the father was saying. And they began to fight and fight and fight. And the neighbors came. And you know who came with the neighbors? Malik ibn Anas, who was at that time beginning to be famous. So when Malik ibn Anas came, he doesn't know this man. He doesn't know the father. He knows this is his sheikh. You are beating up my sheikh. And the father, of course, doesn't know that he's beating up his son. So Malik ibn Anas says, ya sheikh, he's speaking to the father, ya sheikh, go and live somewhere else. He's not getting the point. It's not a hotel that he has booked in. No, this is his house. Or at least that's what he thinks. He said, ya sheikh, go and live somewhere else. He said, listen, that's my house. I am Farrukh. That's his name. I am Farrukh. And the wife is inside the room. And she heard the name. And she heard the voice. And she came out and said, Farrukh, you're still alive? He said, yes. Who the hell is he? This is Rabia, your son. And they started crying and weeping and hugging each other after breaking the face of each other. They were hugging each other, kissing each other. And then Rabia had to leave. Not because he had a Saturday night party with his gigs. No, he had to leave because he is a great scholar, great teacher. So he had to leave. So when he left, the father spoke to the mother, said, what did you do with the 30,000? Come on, you still have hope that you have still 30,000. Anyway, this was the question. What did you do with the 30,000? And this is creativity. She didn't answer. She said, I will tell you what I did with the 30,000 tomorrow. 30,000 dinar tomorrow. He said, okay. So when the following day came and the time for prayer came, she said to the husband, aren't you going to pray? He said, yes. And he made ablution and he went to the mosque. This was the central mosque, not the one in Baker Street. Bigger, bigger, bigger. Thousands and thousands and thousands. And when you go, incidentally, to the mosque of Baghdad, it's not like a single circle in English. Many circles. If you don't like it, there is circle number 20, fiqh. Circle number 30, hadith. Okay, on your right, circle number, tafsir. So he entered and he saw a massive circle. And he saw someone who was sitting at the center of the circle, and that was Rabia. But he was wearing a turban. And when he saw his father coming, he was embarrassed. Because this is, you know, they had a fight yesterday and they hugged each other, but my father never saw me in that context. So he covered his face with the turban. So the father saw the circle very big, very massive. So he sat down and started hearing. Oh, very, very good scholar. MashaAllah, very good scholar. Who is he? Very good scholar. Again, who is he? Anyway, so very good scholar, very good. And then he said to the person sitting next to him, who is this scholar? He said, don't you know him? He's Rabia. And he was shocked. And this was even a bigger shock than knowing yesterday that this was his son. Because when he left, there were no much circles, and he wasn't aware even that his wife is pregnant after 27 years. This household that has the great Malik ibn Anas has a mother saying to him, go to Rabia. That's how famous your son is. So he goes to his wife. He said, I saw a fascinating thing. She said, what did you see? She knows, of course. I saw a massive circle. Rabia was in the middle of it. She said, are you happy with that? He said, of course, no father will be unhappy with that. She said, this is where I spend the 30,000 dinars. This was the product. He said, this is a fascinating news to me. You know what is fascinating also? Is that she invested the money in human development. She didn't buy a mansion, she didn't buy a house, she didn't buy a car, she didn't buy a donkey. She didn't even, look, okay, forget about she. She could have invested in him, but he is a spoiled lad. He goes to Oxford and Cambridge to drink and to mingle with girls, and he comes to her and says, I have ended up with an A-levels. So we have a great mother investing 30,000. We have a great son, recipient of the 30,000. And we have a father coming out of, after 27 years, appreciating the investment. All are sharing the same value of human development and investing in human development. I am done, except with one final story. This is a final story, not of a mother, but of a sister. I told you that Ibn Hajar married two Uns when he was 25 and she was 18, and he educated her and he taught her. Okay, who taught Ibn Hajar? I know Shuyukh, but in the household, who taught him? Ibn Hajar's father died when Ibn Hajar was only 4 years old. His elder sister, Sitt al-Rakb, this is the name, Sitt al-Rakb, she was only 7. There was a male guardian that took care of Sitt al-Rakb, but Sitt al-Rakb was already a respectable girl. You know why? Because her father, the father of Ibn Hajar, when she was 4 or 5, he used to take her with him to the mosque. And he used to make her sit with him in the study circles. She's 4. She has a lollipop. She's crying. She doesn't understand fiqh, but she is sitting. Tomorrow she will understand. Tomorrow she will appreciate. And indeed she did. That when the father died, she was only 7, but she was mature and she was respectable. What did she do, Sitt al-Rakb? The first thing she did was that she retained the library of her father. Her father had a massive library. And it is that library that Ibn Hajar relied upon to accumulate knowledge in Islam. Imagine if the daughter went to Waterstones and sold all these books secondhand. Or imagine if she used them in the winter to light some fire to keep herself warm. Or imagine if she just donated them to a charity shop or to the mosque. Imagine she just got rid of the books because they are not cookery books. Imagine she retained the entire library. Now, there is something unique, by the way, in that. This is not normal. Because back then, books used to be written by hand. So books were expensive. And when you sell books, you become wealthy. So if you had 10,000 books and you sold them, you could become... I'm not talking about a pamphlet, paperback, penguin book for $2.99. I'm talking about proper volumes of hadith and fiqh and tafsir. So don't underestimate and don't take lightly the fact that she decided not to sell the book. Also, I am aware of a great scholar called Ibn al-Jawzi, not Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, another scholar who was called Ibn al-Jawzi. Ibn al-Jawzi was a fascinating speaker. His audience are not in 80 or 90. His audience are in thousands on a daily basis. And of course, at that time, there were no microphones. And when al-Jawzi speaks, someone after 1,000, he will repeat the lecture And after 1,000, another, he will repeat the lecture so that at the end, someone will listen to the lecture. Not by the voice of Ibn al-Jawzi, but by the voice of the third and fourth speaker. A fascinating scholar, prolific writer, he wrote books on everything. In fact, he wrote a book called Akhbar al-Nisa, stories of women or news about women, and all sorts of jokes. And, you know, you laugh at many of this, you know, mad stories that you hear about women and stuff like this. But this is not our topic, because a lot of you will be offended. So, prolific writer. But the point I'm trying to make was that his son was corrupt. So he can give lectures and make you cry. But his son was corrupt. When he died, when Ibn al-Jawzi died, his son, you know what he did? He went and sold all the books that he wrote. All the books that his father wrote, he went and sold them. Ibn al-Jawzi had a massive library at home. He went and sold it all. His father, when he died, he was taken to prison, the father. So the father came after 3 years, went into his house, like the father of Rabi'ah entered into the house. I thought there was a library here. And there was no library. Okay? And he went to his son, what did you do? He said, I sold all your books. I want you to appreciate what the daughter of this great father of Ibn Hajar did. She retained the book. She didn't sell the books. Okay, this is with regards to the books. But the daughter wasn't only a book collector. She didn't have just the hobby for collection. No, she was a serious reader, a well-read. She doesn't read pamphlets. She reads books. And she traveled and met the greatest scholars of her time. She traveled to Mecca. She traveled to Medina. She traveled to Damascus. She traveled to Tunisia. She traveled to Egypt. All that when she was a teenager. All that when she was in her 20s. She got married when she was young. She had 5 daughters. All of them died. Various illnesses. Her husband died. She died at the age of 28. She died very young. When she died, the society cried. The elites, the scholars, the students, she had students. Okay, but what's the point? The point is that Ibn Hajar makes this fascinating confession. He says, Hiya ummi ba'da ummi. She was my mother. To me, she was my second mother. He didn't say she was my eldest sister. She was my second mother. In fact, literally in Arabic, Hiya ummi ba'da ummi. She was my mother after my mother. And then he says, كانت رفيقة بي. She used to be soft and tender. Of course, he's talking about her when she's dead now. So he is remembering. He says, كانت رفيقة بي. She used to love me, kiss me, hug me. انتفعت بآدابها مع صغر سني. I learned a lot from her, despite the fact that she was extremely young. Now, I'm not saying this. I'm not the one who's saying this. You are not the one who's saying this. The one who's saying this is a great scholar. So he knows what he's talking about. And he knows when to say and give credit for those who taught him, because he knows whether it's worthy to give credit to them or not. I am done with made men. And tomorrow we will continue with success. Our first brand, perfume designer brand or theme. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Sleep well. And قولوا قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم فاستغفروه إنه الغفور الرحيم.